he whispered. Garrus's eyes were wide. It didn't really matter what any of them thought, or whether he lived. Secure the medical facility and take the tower, by any means necessary. The doctor worked furiously, sterilizing and reaching for her operating tools. Then she stilled one of her hands enough to insert the fine needle of the device. She withdrew some sort of substance from the robotic spinal column and held it up to the light.
"I don't have any painkillers that will let you remain conscious," she warned. "And introducing something foreign to your system is going to be quite painful."
No way, no how was he going to risk passing out. And the last time he'd been shot with a chemical compound, Allie had been the one doing the injecting. The taurine that had lowered his body temp had nearly killed him, all to escape the heat sensors most military bots came equipped with.
"I can handle it," he said.
Then, at the last minute, he wondered about his own memories, if they'd be corrupted, lost. He'd always been such a hard-ass, never recalling anything in the ray, never wanting to think of his dad. But he'd always imagined that one day, when he was ready, he could find those memories again, relive them when he was smarter, wiser, a hell of a lot less angry. And then he wondered if he'd forget moments with his ma, Alina, Vin. "Kara," he thought.
"Wait,"
he said, just as he felt the pinprick of the needle. And then, a surge, instantaneous and massive. Information everywhere, like water flooding into his brain and choking his own synapses, smothering them. Everything was going under. The droid's mind took his over, but it wasn't a mind. It was a collection of directives, prioritized. Mechanical, black and white, clear-cut instructions to be executed no matter what. Every thought, every impulse Allie had was being drowned out beneath the data, blueprints and names and programs sweeping him up in a current. His brain was swelling. It would burst like a balloon. It felt like the bloating of a new bruise, but a million times more intense. A billion. It would break his brain, then his skull, then crack his skin until he was just light, burning like the sun. He couldn't hold it all. "Breathe," his own voice came to him beneath an all-out assault of sounds and memory and thought. "Breathe. Let it pass." He soared across the threshold of pain. In an instant, the information felt invigorating. When the data stopped flowing, it stopped instantly, and he stumbled off the stool, dizzy with the newfound buzz of data and power. He inhaled deeply and closed his eyes. Nothing hurt anymore. His pain had been replaced by an overwhelming sense of focus. Take the tower. He knew exactly what he was doing and how he was going to do it. He could feel the network channels of 1,000 other droids brushing up against his mind, like tendrils of growth sweeping his feet in a deep pond. "Recirculate new orders," he said. "All droids within a 500-meter radius to stand down." He felt it instantly as his command was communicated to the other droids. He felt it in the pulse of 1,000 answering affirmatives. He felt it in the sudden sense of collapse as so many connected minds went dark and still. Their thoughts, if you could call them that, fell away, and there was nothing to replace them, only a void of memory and feeling and information. Exhausted by this simple effort, drained by the sudden silence, where only a second earlier had been a surge of system data, he staggered back out through the hospital.
"Where are you going?"
Hesse called from behind. Allie ignored him, shuffling past baffled, terrified patients, while soldiers crossed his path in a brisk run toward the tower entrance at the center of the medical facility. He wouldn't join them. All the robo-droids had followed his command and shut themselves down. The satellite was theirs now. He'd done it. His first mission as part of the WFC, and he'd succeeded. Outside, the rain was still pelting down, He clawed for his memories like an addict and saw Kara a thousand different ways all at once, like patchwork. The way she walked, the part in her hair, the line of her neck while she tilted her head back to look at the sun. A thrill moved through him, even if a part of him was desperate to lose them all. He would always give in to this weakness, would always look for Kara in shadows and nostalgia, in what could have been. At least there she was alive. He burst into the tower and raced to the control room where several other WFC soldiers were already dismantling the communication servers. Screw you, Nero, he thought as he yanked at cords and smashed screens. He barely felt his elbow now. Nero's lies were like a toxin polluting the entire galaxy, and Allie was the antibody, fighting it off. Stop, a voice said. A Fontizian had entered the room, one Allie dimly recognized, but he wasn't sure from where. Allie was pretty tall, at least 20 hands high. But this guy was even taller. He wasn't wearing a WFC uniform, but he had tattoos all across his neck, tattoos of the Order of the Light. He moved less like a flesh-and-blood being than like a weapon. Was this one of their commanders? He knew the Order was behind the WFC, but he hadn't been prepared for this. Around him, the other WFC soldiers stopped what they were doing reflexively and waited for word from the Fontizian. So Allie stopped and did the same, his muscles tense and bulging all the while. He wasn't done fighting yet. He wasn't ready to be still. We can't destroy it, the Fontizian leader said. That's exactly what we're here to do, Hesse protested. The Cherums were loyal folks. We only came here to secure it, the Fontizian held up a large hand. Don't you think it's strange for a broadcasting tower to have almost no broadcasting equipment? These are all monitors. So? The Fontizian looked around the room. Do you not understand? The information is flowing in, not out. Dismantle, but pack up as much as you can for evidence. Nero's got access to personal cubes across the galaxy. Allie had always considered himself a decent reader of people. But the Fontizian had a serious poker face. Neutral, if not a little bit uppity, like he was either judging you or didn't give enough of a tahis to judge you. His gray eyes, when they turned to Allie, were similarly inscrutable. Finally, the Fontizian sheathed his sword. Not unimpressive how you've managed to disable the droids, he said. Allie wasn't sure how the guy knew he was the one responsible. He only shrugged. The Fontizian surveyed the shards of equipment strewn across the floor. You've proven yourself quite destructive. It appears your absolution has made you no less desirous of revenge. Some absolution, Allie said bitterly. He wondered if the Fontizian had seen the show Revolutionary Boys, or just the most wanted hollow alerts that had trailed Allie after he was framed for Empress Rhiannon's murder. I'm just here to get what's mine. Which is? My land, my innocence, my body. Justice, Allie said. Wasn't that the whole point of the WFC? To undermine Nero, to bring justice to those who deserve it? It was just an added perk that he got to tear Tahis up along the way. I'm here to put this war to bed. It won't be taken in a single attack, the Fontizian replied. Allie had forgotten that was their deal, the Fontizians. The glass always half empty. I'm Dalin, and I'm recruiting for a special mission. You should join me. Is that an order? It's an invitation. Dalin smiled. Allie did not especially like his smile. An invitation to continue fighting, Allie said dryly. I'm flattered. And can I ask what you're doing on this special mission of yours? Dalin didn't blink. He didn't stop smiling either. We're going to assassinate Nero. And Allie could see, right away, that he was serious. He wasn't even sure Fontizians could lie. Allie thought of the way Kara's eyes shifted colors in the light, the way she messed with her hair when she was thinking, and chewed her lip when she was nervous, and smiled huge when she smiled at all. Kara, the girl he'd never said sorry to. The girl who died because of the war Nero had started.
"Then I accept," he said. "So long as I get to plant the knife myself."
Chapter 11. Kara. Ralier would have been beautiful if the wildflowers weren't covered in blood. Had skirmishes not broken out everywhere. Despite the danger, the actual capital of Ralier was bustling, going on about its business like war wasn't at its doorstep. Pulling a duhat over her head, Kara raised her hand to hail an approaching pod on the dirt road that would lead her to the city. She was more self-conscious than she'd ever been. She had never really liked her face, but who did? Now it was changing, and just this morning she saw her cheekbones had widened and lowered, and nothing felt like hers anymore. Everything was wild and new, and she was propelled forward by the coordinates that would lead her to the Overrider. Once she found it, she could use it to erase the memory of Jocelyn Ta'an for good. Not that she knew how to use the Overrider, or even what the tech looked like, but she could figure that out later. She always did. It was probably a small device not too different from a cube. She didn't want to think of what would happen if she was wrong, or the info didn't pan out, or the lead was cold. The Overrider had to be here. She would accept no other option. Lydia had meant for her to find it. The Lancer, too. Otherwise, why would the message open only at her touch? It had read her DNA. If Lydia had wanted Kara to destroy the Overrider, she had made sure that Kara could find it. And she would destroy it, right after she used it to destroy her past. The icy wind stung her face, its snow an odd comfort on her lips. This, Kara thought as she boarded the pod, was the first choice she had ever made for herself. Behind her, the frontline physician's craft became a small white blip on the sprawl of green. The pod lifted into the sky, and the ocean emerged on Kara's left. Along with a few other passengers whose names she would never know, she hurtled toward the center of the city. In the horizon, a spire appeared. It looked like some giant had stuck a serrated knife in the ground. From the distance, she could see the dark vein of fuel that ran up the middle and around it. Docking stations jutting out at varying heights gleamed in the sun. Ralier's position in the orbit, and the capital's position on the water, had shaped an entire economy at the fueling station's base, creating a compact city where you could purchase anything from rare plant species to stolen engine parts. Some of the other medics had casually floated the idea of checking it out. Supplies were low, and as the war spread through the galaxy, the emergency beacons went off constantly. The demand for help outpaced what they could provide. There weren't enough resources to answer every call, which left the volunteers itching for a break, some sort of distraction from all the death and destruction. Nicola had warned them all against it, though. Last thing any of them needed was some drifter to rake their pockets clean for a sugar pill, or worse, feed them drugs that'd devour them from the inside out. "They'll sell anything on Ralier," she'd said, and she wasn't going to rescue anyone who got themselves into trouble. But Kara had no choice. She knew the others wouldn't notice that she was gone, especially given the latest surprise. Rhiannon had allied with Nero. The headline was on every hollow channel you could find, and people were worked up about it. Kara wouldn't try to understand what that meant. She definitely didn't want to know what it would mean for Rhiannon. Half the hollow feeds were doing nothing but urging Jocelyn to come forward, to salvage what they were already calling her sister's failure as an empress. Even more reason Kara had to succeed in her mission. And quickly. The sooner she destroyed Jocelyn's memory, the sooner her sister could rule in peace. The pod dropped her at the base of the fueling tower. The coordinates led her deeper into the city, into the warehouse district, where all the manufacturing for the outer belt had once occurred. She wrapped her arms around herself, wishing she'd prepared better for the atmosphere. The crisp air had almost cleared her head, but the noise cluttered it again. Ships and pods roared overhead while people from all over the system talked in incessant streams around her. The constant stimulation wasn't helping. Another headache was coming on. The pain behind her eyes was sharp and steady, pulsing like a drill deeper into her gray matter. She had lifted a portable positioning system from the medbay, and it clicked softly in her hand, warming her fingers with its electric heat. Skyscrapers gave way to low, squat buildings made of brick. Here, in the warehouse district, narrow sidewalks were lined with vendor stalls, and huddles of people hawking plants, pills, and spare engine parts wrenched her left and right and left again. Pods flew by on the street. For a second, Kara wished Allie was with her. When Allie found her on the Zeppelin, she'd felt so much less alone, like someone was looking out for her, and like she had someone to look after, too. But that was just her being silly and stupid. As if something good could happen. As if something good could last. She moved away from the main thoroughfares, pushed her way toward the coordinates into a claustrophobic alley that, without warning, emptied into a small plaza, buzzing with merchants selling the kind of black market wares that would get a person arrested on any other planet. Vendors hawked the high of a lifetime and shouted about miracle tech that could only be fake. In the distance, Kara could hear live music, hollering, pharmaceutically enhanced chatter. The crumbling stone buildings that ringed the square, once grand factories, now seemed to ooze desperation. Broken windows, subtle indications of skin for sale inside, black mold webbed in the stone. She had goosebumps from the cold, but unease settled into her skin. This was where the overrider was? Kara stopped short as a man with a hose stuck between his teeth nearly clipped her. A gas guzzler. He'd siphon fuel from a docked ship and sell it to someone looking to save a few dollars. Watch it, she called to his back. A child, a little Misu with yellow skin and a narrow upper body, pushed past her at a wobbly sprint. There was a bundle of bags with brightly colored powders tucked under her arm. Excuse you, Kara said, even if the little girl was long gone and couldn't hear her. She moved to brush off the residual powder that had gotten on her arm, but someone grabbed her wrist and tugged her back. Hard. She barely had time to register the WFC uniform before Issa pressed her against the wall. Are you trying to get yourself killed? Issa said. I could ask you the same thing, Kara nodded to the stitches across Issa's neck as she pushed Issa's hands away. The soldier eased up on her grip. Nice to see you up and about, Kara said, not at all sweetly, even if she was glad to see her. People milled around them, but no one seemed to pay attention or care. Did you follow me here? Maybe I was on the same pod as you. A vulnerable look flitted across Issa's face, then was gone. I mean, yeah. Kara made a rolling gesture with her hands, urging Issa to go on. What happened last night, after the surgery? Did we talk? Kara understood then. Issa was just worried about what she had revealed. Not really, she said. No need to make Issa relive her confession all over again. Kara wasn't one to judge anyway. Issa seemed relieved. She looked away, squinting in the direction of the dying sun. Kara's stomach roiled at the sight of the wound on her neck, still raw-looking where Issa had tried to gouge out her cube. You said something about seizures, or
Something about how I should say I have them? Did someone ask? Kara said, a streak of panic zipping up her spine. No, I slipped out before anyone saw I was awake. Issa looked at her. What did you tell them? That if they resuscitated your cube, it would trigger a fatal seizure. So they disabled it because of you? Issa asked. Kara shrugged. How did you even know that would work? My mom's a... Kara cut herself off and swallowed hard. My mom was a neuroscientist.
So you just picked up some expertise along the way then? Issa said.
She looked around and they were silent for a beat. Well, for what it's worth, thank you. For telling the medics what's what. And for being there.
She turned to Kara again, gesturing to her bright white frontline physician's smock.
No one should travel alone around here. Especially a collusion girl.
Do I look like I need a babysitter?
For some reason, Kara felt defensive. Even if just a day ago, Issa had been a patient in her care. Weak. Nearly dead.
Whoa! I'm just saying people aren't thrilled with Kalu starting a war and dropping soldiers on every piece of land they can reach, Issa said.
And anyway, don't think of it as a babysitter. Think of it as me watching your back.
It's the least I can do since you saved my life and everything.
Actually, I almost killed you, Kara admitted.
But you didn't.
Issa's eyes burned into hers, and there was something curious, intense about it. Kara wondered what it would be like to dedicate yourself to vigilante justice, to be constantly on the lookout for ways to help those in need, to be willing to sacrifice your life for the safety of others. It was a kind of bravery that seemed beyond her imagination. And it made her feel ashamed.
Issa's gaze shifted into a smile, a full-on grin. Besides, I was heading this way myself. Now that my cube's dead, I need something a little more old-fashioned to communicate with the rest of the crew. Something Uni can't track. I'm thinking a third eye.
Kara knew them. They were called I-3s. And Lydia had had one, for sentimental reasons, she'd always said. A clunky piece fit around the neck and collected dust on their shelf, and Kara always tried to hide it when people came over. It hadn't looked cool and vintage, just outdated and embarrassing. But now she wondered if Lydia had used it, if there were secrets communicated with the other G1K scientists.
Kara was startled by the sudden, overwhelming desire to take whatever it was Issa was willing to give. Help, a smile, kindness. She wanted to confess everything. What she was looking for, what it meant, what she had lost along the way. But she didn't know whether or not to trust Issa. And anyway, she'd leave, just like everyone else did.
I'm good on my own, Kara said.
Issa shrugged. Whatever you say, she replied, as if she doubted every word Kara had said. See you back at the ship, then?
Kara nodded. She couldn't speak. She was worried that she might instead ask Issa to stay, just so she wouldn't be so alone. But she watched Issa slip off into the crowd, swallowing the impulse to call her back. She had to be alone. The message was intended only for her.
Kara reached into her pocket for the cipher, and a jolt of panic shot through her.
It was gone. She swallowed her nerves and swept her eyes across the small plaza. How could she have been so careless? Had she dropped it? Had someone taken it? When Lydia combed through plant specimens, her research, she looked for anomalies. As she relaxed, the crowd of individual people, the clutter of stalls, began to dissolve into mere shapes. Then, these shapes, too, began to dissolve into patterns. And finally, she latched onto a soul who seemed tense, who seemed to be watching her. It was the little Misu. Their eyes locked for a split second before the girl turned and ran. Heart racing, Kara shoved her way through the stalls and the people milling between them, catching sight of the little girl just to lose her again. She crossed the street, and Kara let out a scream as the Misu dodged a pod that sped past.
Kara tried to follow, but a quick succession of pods flew by, a zipping sound in their wake as they cut through the air. She split her attention between the oncoming traffic and the girl, who disappeared into a building across the way. When the coast was clear, Kara ran after her. The building she'd entered gave no signs of its purpose. It didn't even look inhabited. Kara followed through what was once a grand brick archway and shoved open a heavy door. It was colder inside than it was out. A whole other world opened up inside the still-functioning factory, with low light and people hunched over, organized in more rows than she could count. There were conveyor belts and the sound of compressed air at a regular interval, and hundreds of workers who barely looked up at her before returning to whatever minute detail they were in charge of. It looked this way all across the immense ground floor. Kara took a close look at a nearby worker's handiwork and realized it now. It had the makings of a third eye. They were making comtech for people who didn't have cubes or couldn't afford them. The Misu girl ran up a spiral staircase in the back corner, and Kara followed. Upstairs was a labyrinth, curtains separating off spaces into private nooks. Kara realized too late as she was trampling through that these were workers' sleeping spaces. She went hopping through, stopping and starting, trying to give people their privacy. But she got tangled in curtains and woke so many souls up. There was no logic to the layout she could immediately discern. The hallway seemed to have a system all its own. Kara chased and chased. She caught a glimpse of the Misu turning a corner, and she followed, stopping at the end of a long, dark corridor. The girl entered a door that slammed behind her. Kara stood at the other end, chills working their way up her spine. She fought every instinct to turn around. She had to get her cipher. She needed it to access the Overrider. Or, what if the Overrider was here? The knocker was missing. Stolen, probably. She tapped lightly instead with her fist. A few seconds later, a hidden panel slotted open in the door, and a pair of bright gray eyes peered out at her. "Collusion girl," he said in lieu of a greeting. "You look like you're in need of guidance." No. Or was it yes? She looked down the corridor behind her. There was nothing. It seemed longer than it did on the way in. Usually, she was good at this kind of thing, bluffing, lying, but her confidence felt chipped away, thinned out. Her head spun. She turned around, not knowing what to say except for the truth. "The Lancer sent me." Without another word, the man slotted the eyepiece closed with a final sounding click. Kara lurched backward, tightening her jacket around her, suddenly feeling cold and exposed. At the other end of the corridor, a Dirkatsian in an oversized coat looked in her direction, his yellow eyes catching in the light. She turned the other way. A Charum leaning against the wall dropped his eyes quickly. But not so quickly, she didn't understand he'd been observing her. Kara had the sudden, pressing feeling that she had made a mistake. She shouldn't be here. She should go, disappear, melt back into the darkness behind her. She flew out of the corridor, hurtled between rooms as the Charum seemed to follow her, and burst into the plaza outside. Her heart stopped when she spotted Issa not 5 feet away, wearing a third eye now, almost exactly like the one she remembered from childhood. "Find what you were," Issa swallowed a sound of surprise when Kara grabbed her arm roughly. Her heart skipped. A man in a white robe was staring at her. Kara risked a glance. On the other side of the plaza, another man was watching her. How many were there? "I think I made a mistake," panic swallowed her, spotting a narrow street between buildings that she prayed would lead back toward a pod that would take them back to the ship. She hauled Issa that way. "What in the Chartois is going on?" Issa said in a low voice. But Kara could tell she didn't really expect an answer. Somehow, she had felt the danger, too. Another mistake. They careened around the corner only to realize they had reached a dead end. They would never get out. A silhouette had already appeared at the end of the alleyway. Waiting. They'd communicated via cube. Kara could never outrun a networked enemy.
They spun around and tried to backtrack toward the opening that led out to the plaza. They were close. They ran alongside windows and saw the crowd in the plaza was thinning as the sun edged close to the horizon. Kara could more easily pick out her observers now, many of them still idling at the stalls, pretending to be buyers.
"This way," Issa said, her voice low with understanding. She'd seen them, too, so Kara wasn't imagining things.
Issa tugged Kara toward another alleyway, this one concealed behind a hanging curtain, and plunged through it. Kara struggled for a second with the heavy fabric before ducking in after her. The first thing she saw was Issa, struggling with a man nearly twice her size. Her heart lurched as Issa caught a heavy blow directly to the head. She staggered sideways, coughing, clutching at her chest as if something pained her there.
"Run!"
Issa gasped out, but Kara moved instead for Issa. A foot kicked her knees from behind, and as she fell, a rough-hewn bag was pulled over her head. An acrid synthetic scent filled her nose. Kara fought wildly. Her foot made contact with flesh, but instead of letting her go, yet another pair of hands seized her wrists and bound them. She thought of Ali. What would he have done if he were here? But he wasn't, she reminded herself. He wasn't.
"Stop that," someone hissed, a woman's voice.
Kara tried to scream, but as soon as she opened her mouth, fingers forced the gag in, practically down her throat.
"We're not going to hurt you," another voice said into her ear. "Princess Jocelyn."
Chapter 12. Rhiannon. It had been a week since Dallin had left Rhi. A week since she'd publicly aligned herself with Nero. In that time, she and Nero had come to various agreements that they would announce in a joint broadcast later today. Both Kalu and Fontis would pull out of neutral territories, air travel would be reinstated in the Relia Quadrant, and both warring parties had agreed to a ceasefire over Raten airspace. For now, she was maintaining the facade of a unified front. And so far, it had worked. Along with everything else Nero touched, her popularity soared. Well, not soared, exactly, but she'd been featured favorably on the Hollows. Her approval rating was up. And though Rhi couldn't stand to see her own frozen smile and stiffly worded statement replayed endlessly on the Hollows, as time passed, she was increasingly certain that the decision, her decision, had been a necessary one. For the first time since the war began, the United Planets had agreed to converge in Cebu to discuss the terms of an intergalactic treaty. Their cooperation, too, a result of Nero's diplomacy, especially his announcement of a dispersal of his troops from around Raeta. Soon, she hoped, she would restore enough peace and enough faith in the Ta'an dynasty that she'd be free to oust Nero for good. For now, the war still raged, ravaging the system in tiny pockets that grew larger and more unpredictable with each passing day. The blast on Naufruma, another rash of explosions in the outer belt, a few skirmishes that, somehow, always seemed to occur near Uniforce peacekeeping troops. Rhi shivered, wondering where else violence had stuck itself, like a sliver burrowed underneath the skin. Loneliness had crept into her, too, in the same way, slow and unexpected. She caught herself balancing the coin across her knuckles, moving it between her index finger and pinky just like Dallin had done. His departure was like a sudden sting. The pain was easy to ignore at first. And by the time it had spread through her like an infection, it was too late. The ache wasn't like missing her parents. That wound was huge, undeniable, and she had been able to staunch it with the promise of revenge. She had no idea how to rid herself of the ache of missing Dallin. It was her own doing, after all. She turned the hollow off. Rhi had insisted all the guards keep their distance. She couldn't stand the idea of a stranger taking Dallin's place. It only made his absence more noticeable. Silence filled the room, thick as smoke from a fire,
Then, there was a flash of something uncomfortable. The feeling of being watched. Don't be such a little girl. But it wasn't unreasonable to be so on edge with everything that had happened. Though he ostensibly took measures to protect her, she couldn't put anything past Nero. He could still have her killed and simply frame someone else. Again. Maybe the negotiations were just a game. She took comfort in the fact that Lana was positioned outside her door. The sun had gone down while she'd sat here watching the hollows alone. Moonlight from Nau Fruma peeked through the slats of her balcony door, razoring the dark tiled floor with light. Again, the feeling of being watched pricked her skin into goosebumps. She couldn't give in to paranoia. Couldn't appear weak. Rhi walked to the balcony door, craving something she did not know how to name. Even though going outside was discouraged, the threats against her life weren't few, as Dalin might have said. She punched a code into the door's keypad. Obediently, it opened. Moonlight flooded in. Cool air drenched her. The smell of roses from the garden, her mother's garden, drifted into the room. A shadow flicked in the corner of her eye. Fear spiked in her blood. She backed away from the balcony door and closed it with the punch of a button, straining to see the dark corners of her room. Like a child, she thought again, a little girl afraid of the dark. But now she had Vayrin's knife in the folds of her robe. Then, as soon as she relaxed her grip on the hilt, the balcony door slid open for a second time. A shadow moved across the way and re-lunged. She wielded her knife, but not fast enough. The assailant knocked it out of her hand. The defensive movement was familiar, the way the person wove back, struck in a wide arc with the left hand. Suddenly, Rhi could hardly breathe. Julian? Rhi called out into the shadow. He stepped into the light and pulled back his hood. His sandy hair was longer now, and even though it had been only weeks since that night under the meteor shower, he looked older. It was something about the cut of his jaw, the line of his brow. Her heart warmed, every fear melted away. Her pulse sped up with excitement, with anticipation. He'd finally come. "Till I see you next," he'd said that day on Nau Fruma when they last parted. The stars were raining down on them then. "You got my messages," Rhi moved toward him instinctively. And she paid the price. Now it was his turn to lunge, pinning her to the dresser. She tried to call for help, but he muffled her scream with a rough palm. She spun to the right, but he anticipated it, blocked her off, and grabbed her forearms. "He knows," Rhi realized. He knew about Vayrin's death. She wiggled her left elbow free, but again he blocked it deftly. It was a feint to bring her legs around his torso from behind anyway, but he easily grabbed her legs and turned her on her side, like he'd known that was coming, because he had. He picked her up, took his left forearm to her neck and slammed her against the wardrobe. His right arm pinned her left wrist down. Rhi knew this dance. It was skill. It was practiced. It had happened 1,000 times before. She could hardly breathe, though it had little to do with the arm against her throat. She wasn't used to their height difference. Had he grown in the short time between Nau Fruma and now? At least some things hadn't changed. It was clear he still favored his left side. It was the same hold he'd put her in the last time they sparred. Rhi hadn't looked up then. She'd been afraid he would kiss her. Now, she was afraid he'd do something much worse. Rhi looked up this time, but darkness shielded Julian's clear blue eyes from view. The eyes that used to tell her everything she'd needed to know, even before he spoke. Heat spilled off him. Being here with him hovering over her was new and unknowable and terrifying. Her best friend, the boy she used to race through the sand dunes on Nau Fruma. The one she'd said goodbye to under a sky raining down in rock and fire. "Did you think I wouldn't find out?" His lips brushed against her ear. Rhi squeezed her eyes shut. He'd come to make her pay for what she'd done. A vision flashed through her memory, visceral and organic. Julian's father, Vairin, bleeding at her hand. He doesn't know, she thought. He didn't know Vairin had tried to kill her first. Julian pressed his forearm harder into her throat. Her windpipe strained under the pressure. Heat and sweat gathered in all the places their skin touched. Wrist, arm, thigh. The reality sunk in that he was truly here to kill her. That every moment they'd shared before this meant nothing in the face of Vairin's death. Did she think their friendship was so powerful as to make her immune?
Think you're special,
someone had whispered in the crowd on Tanopa when she'd rushed forward in her haphazard attempt to kill Siotra.
Remember what he used to say? Julian asked. That you weren't a tactical thinker. You react. You never get in front of the fight.
Shut your mouth! Rhee eased her free hand behind the folds of her robe, then remembered he had kicked away her knife. Was she willing to stab him, like she had his father? We're friends. The thought raced through the wrinkles in her brain. Julian wanted her to die. Why did this devastate her, when Rhee knew herself that the singular desire for revenge was more powerful than friendship, reason, love? Hadn't she done the same thing? Blamed a man for the actions of another? Rhee gathered herself. This needed to be fought like a battle.
He also said I was graceful where you were clumsy, she told Julian now. What was that word he used to describe you?
Uninspired. Julian pressed harder. You know what's uninspired? This charade to take back your throne is uninspired. Killing him was uninspired. Partnering with Nero? Uninspired.
Tears sprang to her eyes, though she wasn't sure if they were from pain or Julian's words. But it was all true, wasn't it?
Is that why you killed my father? He whispered. Because he saw right through you? Because he knew how power-hungry you really were? No!
She was almost glad that was all she could manage. She felt her dignity, her resolve, wane with every second she stared up at him. At the hate in his eyes. At the memory of Vairin's blood spilling over her knife, hands, cloak. If Julian didn't have her pinned, would she have already dropped to her knees and begged forgiveness? But no. His father had tried to kill her.
Then why? He spit.
He didn't know that Vairin had been the one to betray her. He didn't know that his father was the one to make the deal with Nero first. A deal to destroy Rhee and stop her ascent. She could tell him now. Set the record straight. But for what? To clear her name on the off chance Julian would spare her life? It would only sully the version of Vairin he had, reframe every memory into something dishonorable and sinister. The father, the trainer, the loyalist. He'd disappear. Rhee had already killed Julian's father. She couldn't kill the memory of him. She wouldn't. Instead, she drove her hip into him. He'd budged, only barely, but it was enough of a surprise. He'd loosened his hold on her wrist. She yanked her right hand out of Julian's sweaty grip, her elbow making sickening contact with his neck. He stumbled back, gasping. Rhee lifted her knife from the floor and pointed it at him. Julian was swimming in anger, she could see, focused on everything he thought he knew. They stood a meter apart. He pulled his own weapon out of his waistband behind him. It was a hatchet. Small, compact. She scrambled for the memory. He used to use it in the greenhouse, or to dig up rocks in the garden. Her mind reeled with the need to remember this completely inane detail, like part of her was desperate to go back, back, back.
That knife doesn't belong to you, he said, using the hatchet to point at Vairin's blade. What he'd meant to say was, it belongs to me.
She twirled it. A showy, obstinate move, even as her heart was breaking.
Then come and get it, Rhee said.
Suddenly, another organic memory rose.
She'd found a shell of a crab once by the shore, perfectly preserved. Rhee had held it up to the sun, admiring it, when Julian snatched it out of her hand and jumped into the river.
"Come and get it," he'd yelled to her, while she peeled off her ceremonial dress to dive in after him.
She couldn't think of such things. Not of Julian. Her Julian. In the dojo, they'd never held back. The more skill and stamina you brought, the more you showed respect to your opponent. You had to challenge one another truly. It was in the service of both fighters becoming better than they were. But their sparring never had truly violent ends. It was never about winning. And it was never about harm. But tonight was different. If Julian was here to avenge his father, he would fight until the death. And Rhee would not take that honor away from him. She had only one option. She didn't have the luxury to die. Not now, not with a threat of Nero. She was the Empress and had come back to rule, to reclaim her responsibility and live the legacy she'd been born into. Which meant that Julian would die tonight. He moved in, his eyes never leaving hers. Rhee swiped at the air, just missing as he ducked. He was only a shadow, she told herself, an opponent. They moved in a half circle around her bed, and when he swung his axe, she ducked, and it wedged into the wood post behind her. The sound of wood cracking startled her. She hadn't realized they fought in near silence, as they always had in the dojo. Rhee scrambled back, and Julian struggled with the axe. He couldn't free it. Rhee thought she heard footsteps down the hall. Someone had heard them. Lana, she thought. Lana and her bow. Julian, Rhee tried, but he threw a punch with his protected arm. Rhee slashed wildly. If she'd hurt him, she couldn't tell. He drove his forearm into her elbow to disarm her, and the knife went clattering to the ground. They both dove. Rhee ended up on top of him. She punched his ribs as he finally seized the knife. She recoiled as he slammed the knife toward her at full force and just managed to block his wrist with her forearm. The blade was so close it fogged at her breath. He was stronger than he'd been only a few months ago. She used to be able to best him in a fight. The thought occurred to her suddenly that maybe, all along, he'd let her win. Julian. Her Julian. Suddenly his face in the darkness seemed to solidify. The mouth grim that so often she had seen wide with sudden laughter. The nose she'd broken when they were 7 years old, landing her first punch after he'd taunted her that she couldn't. Rhee swung off him sideways, and the momentum rolled him off his balance. She grabbed the knife and pinned him beneath her. She brought the blade to his neck. They were panting. The moonlight cut in, and she saw how he had changed in just a few weeks' time. His jaw had squared off in anger. His floppy blonde hair was wet, clinging to his forehead. Rhee couldn't help herself. She swept it away. And there was the blue in his irises. Electric, the color of the sky she'd dreamed about. Julian. Their friendship had saved her life. He was the only person who'd ever felt like an extension of herself. She never felt alone if Julian was there. In truth, he was the only one who could stand her. Now all she felt was the heat off his body, the hatred in his stare. He wanted her to die. No, he wanted to punish her.
"What's stopping you?" he said. The blade trembled in her hand. "Do it."
"Shut up," she whispered. She remembered how he used to egg her on. Called from ahead to make her swim faster or run harder. He expected her to be her best, to be his equal. Rhee thought of the summer she'd spent, the afternoons trying to kick up into a handstand. How he'd been there rattling off facts so she might find her balance in distraction and ease.
"This is your legacy, Rhiannon," he said. The flatness of his voice stung more than any insult. "War. Death. Disloyalty. Wouldn't the ancestors be proud?"
"I said, shut up!"
when she'd been sent to Naufruma after her parents died. He'd chased her out into the dunes. When she screamed, so did he. They'd been so young, yelling until their throats were ragged, screaming at the injustice of it all. Tears poured from Rhi's eyes. Sand stuck to her face and tangled her hair, and Julian did nothing but sit next to her, staring out toward the horizon. He didn't say anything while she cried. He didn't need to. In a sudden movement, she threw the knife across the floor. For a second, he stared at her. His eyes changed. The blue darkened. With a sudden roar of fury, he shoved her off him and dove for the knife. She kneeled there numbly, quietly, even as he drove her backward. Her head hit the floor, but she didn't feel it. She didn't want to feel anything. He straddled her, the blade to her neck. Rhi felt his weight on her, felt the muscles in his thighs tighten around her. He was shaking.
"Why?"
he asked. The cruelty had drained away, and he'd become that same little boy again, desperate to know. He grabbed her chin and forced her to look at him. She saw the scar on the underside of his chin from when he'd fallen off the palace wall. She saw everything. All at once, the love turned to terror, the boy she'd betrayed.
"How could you?"
he repeated, and his voice broke.
"How could you?" he said again.
She blinked back tears. "I didn't want to," she said. The knife pressed into her neck. The cool metal, the sharp edge. He really would kill her. Rhi would let everyone down, but she wouldn't blame him.
"Believe me."
What else could she say to the boy on his knees, mourning the father he'd loved? Nothing would bring Vayrin back, certainly not the truth. Nothing would bring any of them back. Her parents were dead, and she'd never found her sister. And didn't Dalin leave because she'd proven herself unworthy?
"Drop it."
Lana's voice was quiet, calm, and deadly. Julian froze. Lana was silhouetted in the doorway, with her loaded bow aimed straight at his head.
"Lana," Rhi called out. "Don't! He's...
my friend.
He's the son of Lancer Vayrin and Marguerite Zolana."
She listed out his lineage. An old moon custom reserved for warriors before a fight. Her voice was raw, desperate.
"You will not kill him! This is our fight!"
Rhi didn't know how Lana might react, but she hadn't expected she'd drop her bow to the ground and press her index fingers to either eye. Rhi knew it was a religious sign of respect, and a way for those who follow Vadhun to honor the dead. In one silent movement, Lana kneeled.
"What are you doing?" Rhi asked.
"Honoring the memory of a hero," she said, bowing her head.
"Lancer Vayrin made great sacrifices for the resistance."
Rhi shook her head.
"No," she thought. "It couldn't be true. If Lancer was a hero, that meant..."
"Your father," Lana continued, speaking to Julian,
"paid the ultimate price for his loyalty."
Chapter 13. Alyosha. As the WFC moved south, the rain on Ustral turned to snow. It had a fresh, metallic scent to it, and a habit of landing everywhere, on Ali's eyelashes, on his lips, and on the open field outside. Dalin had recruited him on the satellite mission and now prepped him for the debriefing in the makeshift locker room, which was really just an insulated tent that barely kept them safe from the cold, for now. It had been 5 days since they raided the tower, and the WFC had spent almost every hour strategizing, repairing weapons and, most important, attempting to analyze the equipment they'd stolen from the satellite control center. Ali could barely focus. What with all the yo-yoing between burning rage and the moments of a deep, quiet blue, and a feeling that his heart had been flooded with ice water
He'd always been so good at keeping it casual, cool, going with the flow. And now, he caught himself glaring up at the sky, as if Vadhan were watching now. As if the creator himself had stood back and let the whole world burn. They had found sanctuary among the Ustralite army, which had recently come out and pledged allegiance to Fontis. This was all despite the fact that northern Ustral, where the satellite they had disabled was located, now claimed allegiance to Nero. No surprise there. Nero had been paying northern Ustral handsomely for the use of its massive satellite. But Dalin's hunch had proven correct. The sophisticated comms they'd torn out of the control center were actually a slightly outdated type of hard drive, meant to store information, not communicate it. Information was coming in via the satellite. Information from all over the galaxy. The hard drives were encrypted and hard to crack, but the snippets the WFC intelligence team had extracted so far had a memory-like quality to them. A personal quality. The WFC had already long suspected Nero was spying on their cubes, even while they were off. But they never thought even he would stoop so low as to poach data from ordinary civilians, let alone civilians as widespread as the satellite could reach. And Ali thought he had problems. The entire galaxy was fracturing. His own puny life was at best a messy microcosm of the truth. In the end, everything always fell apart. Ali ran the tap and cupped his palms to make a bowl, collecting the freezing water in his hands. He brought it to his face and felt the cold shoot down his spine. He made his way over to the bench where they had thrown all their stuff and shrugged into his shirt, buttoning it up. Distantly, he heard the tinny voice of a newscaster beaming off somebody's handheld, replaying the same endlessly dissected news of Rhiannon and Nero's diplomatic gambit. Ali wondered what Kara would think of Rhiannon's new alliance with Nero. And then, he remembered that Kara didn't have an opinion and never would again. The grief was sudden and so deep it numbed his bones, and he fluttered his eyes closed.
"You don't look well," Dalin observed as he slipped into his own WFC-issued button-up. "Are you in pain?"
A ray of sunshine, this one. Lots of the soldiers messed around and blew off steam, but not Dalin. Super cut and lean all around, whiter than a ghost, with blonde eyebrows so light you sometimes couldn't even tell they were there. Dalin moved like he was slicing through the air, chasing demons off with that fierce face of his. But what tripped up Ali the most was a long, precise scar on the upper left side of his chest, like someone had tried to slash up his heart. The scar puckered in places from where it had been stitched. Ali didn't even bother asking for the story. This was a dude whose idea of bonding was assassination. He had, however, figured out where he recognized Dalin from. Holovision broadcasts of Empress Rhiannon's return to Cebu. This was the Fontisian guard who'd picked Rhiannon up like a doll and tossed her over his shoulder in the midst of a street brawl outside the palace walls. Only now, the Empress was colluding with Nero, and Dalin was no longer with her in Cebu, but here, planning a kill.
"I'm all right."
It was the first time he'd been with Dalin alone since they'd headed south. He nodded to Dalin's chest.
"I bet that hurt."
Dalin shrugged.
"I can't say the recovery was too pleasant."
Ali turned away and slipped into his fatigues with a bounce.
"Some sort of freaky initiation into the Order?"
He tried to make it sound casual.
"I'm no longer part of the Order,"
Dalin answered plainly. Ali thought for a second a flicker of pain passed over his face, but it was gone so fast he wasn't sure. Dalin turned on his heel to exit the tent. Ali followed him, half amused, half annoyed by Dalin's seeming resistance to any kind of conversation that wasn't tactical.
"I thought those vows were for life," Ali said.
The cold air hit him hard, especially at his elbow,
which had been healed at the camp's med center with a handheld stem cell gun. Pain shot up the bone in the sweater, but Allie tried his best not to react.
They are, Dolan said as they fell into step, walking side by side to the outpost of war.